Good afternoon, America. This is Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, and welcome to the Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C., that the government does not want you to know. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk about the recent killing by Israel of the Hamas leader that they killed just recently in Gaza. And we're going to talk in general about the situation in Israel. I want to know what you think about it. And then we're going to move on in the second part of the hour to talk about the inside scoop in Congress, all that's going on there that you may not have heard before. So let's go through the issues. First of all, again, this is Mark Levine. He used to work as an attorney in Congress. And I was really surprised by all the information that we had there that was not conveyed to the American people. That's why I decided to come on the radio and bring you the inside scoop. I've been on radiopower.org now. This is my first week. I've had a radio show out of Washington for some time now on Sunday nights. But I want to welcome all my radiopower.org listeners on weekdays. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll call into the show. It is your calls that make the show, and the call number is toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. Now, let's talk about what's going on in the Middle East, specifically what's going on in Israel. Do you think that the killing of Yassin, the leader of Hamas, do you think that killing that sheikh was justified? Do you think it was fair? Do you think it was unfair? Do you think it's likely to lead to a huge problem in the Middle East? And do you think that might be justified? Some say that Yassin was Israel's Osama bin Laden. He was the head of a terrorist group that killed hundreds of Israelis and injured thousands, and that it was absolutely justified to kill him. But I want to talk larger. I want to talk larger about what's going on in the Middle East. You know, a lot of people, I think, don't know the history of that region. And they might focus on the latest attack back and forth and just say, why don't these people stop killing each other? And one thing I want to do this hour is I want to explore the history of the Middle East. I want to explore the history of Israel and the Arabs. Some of it you may know, some of it you may not know. And really examine why it is that the situation is the way it is today and what you think is the way out. One thing that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon proposes is to withdraw from Gaza. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think it's a good idea to build a security fence to protect Israel from terrorist attacks? Do you think it's a good idea, as Sharon has proposed, to annex parts of the West Bank that have Jewish settlements and to give to the Palestinians Arab areas of Israel? I want to know what you think about all of this. You know, what's interesting to me about this question of Israel is that sometimes it cuts across party lines. Now, those of you that have heard me before know I am no fan of this current president. In fact, in the second hour, we're going to go into a lot of details on what the Republican Congress is doing because, well, I think you should know about it if you don't. And we're going to give you the inside scoop on all of that in the second hour. Things like trying to deny overtime pay, things like the charges by a man named Mr. Foster, who was in the Medicare agency, who found out that the bill was going to be $150 billion more expensive, tried to tell his boss, told his boss was told he'd be fired if he told Congress. We're going to talk about all of that. Also talk about what's going on in the Supreme Court. Talk about Scalia's refusal to recuse himself. Talk about the under God ruling and the Pledge of Allegiance. We got a lot to talk about in the second hour, but I want to focus right now in the first hour on the Middle East. I want to know from you if you think Israel's actions were fair. I also want to know what you think about Palestinian suicide killers. I mean, is this justified by Israeli oppression? There was a case just yesterday where there was a 16-year-old boy, you have to call him a boy, he's 16 years old, who was walking in with a suicide vest trying to blow up soldiers. They found out that he had it on, and he cried and said he didn't want to die, and the Israelis sent a robot to give him scissors to cut off the vest. And his brother said, you know, he really didn't know what he was doing. I want to know what you think about this. What do you think about a group that sends out children to kill themselves in the hope that they're going to kill other Israeli children? I want to know, why don't you think the Palestinians have discovered what has worked in history, even in the midst of horrible oppression, and that is nonviolent protest. Martin Luther King had a point. Nonviolence can change a democracy. Now, I'm not saying it can change a dictatorship. But Israel is a democracy, and I'm convinced, but I want to hear from you what you think. I'm convinced that the reason Sharon's in power today is precisely because of Arafat's refusal to negotiate with Barak in 2000 Camp David. And that if the Palestinians were to try nonviolence, give peace a chance, do what Gandhi did, do what Martin Luther King did, nonviolent protests, put down their arms, I think they would have a state in a minute. But I want to hear what you think. I know it's funny, you know, some people on the left and on the right are pro-Israel. Some people on the left and on the right are anti-Israel. Some are more sympathetic to the Palestinians. It's not necessarily a left-right question. But, you know, I don't feel that my job here on the Inside Scoop is only to talk about left-right issues. We need to talk about the issues that matter in the world today. And I want to hear from you. Do you think Israel's fence is fair? Do you think its settlements are fair? Do you think that it's fair to kill the leader of Hamas? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think maybe we should take out Arafat too? Is that a good idea? I want to hear from you. Again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. I want you to come on the air and talk with me. If you want to send me an email, you can do that as well by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Then, as I said, in the second half of the hour, we're going to talk and give you the inside scoop on what's going on in Congress and the Republican Party. And then tomorrow, we're going to devote the show to the 9/11 Commission, to what Richard Clark has been saying, his explosive testimony that Bush just wasn't watching what was going on. That Clark warned him there was going to be an attack on the United States that would kill hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans, and Bush was just thinking about splitting up Iraqi oil fields. You know, when Paul O'Neill said it, people weren't trusting him. But now that we got Richard Clark saying it, I mean, with all due credit, I said this a year ago on the Inside Scoop. But now we have Bush insiders saying this information. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. I hope to have a representative of the victim's family here. Victims' families. We're going to talk about all this stuff tomorrow. But right now, let's talk about the Middle East. Let's talk about the situation in Israel. I want to hear from you, and we'll be back with more from the situation in the Middle East and your calls right after these messages.
And other political cynics scoff at citizens' efforts to reform America's money-corrupted political process, saying it's as futile as trying to teach table manners to a hog. The effort wears you out, and it only annoys the hog. That's cute, but if the cynics would only lift their eyes from their myopic focus on Washington, they would see something big taking place in such diverse states as Maine and Arizona. Citizens in both places have already passed grassroots initiatives providing for dramatic reform, public financing of elections. These clean election initiatives give candidates of any party the chance to finance both their primary and general election campaigns with public funds, provided they forego taking special interest money. Not only does this help get corrupt money out of the process, but it also means a regular person can run for office again. Since a school teacher, taxi driver, farmer, shopkeeper, steel worker, or anyone else has access to a pool of money to make them financially competitive with the incumbents. Maine and Arizona have run two election cycles under clean money laws, and the results would warm the cockles of the coldest cynic's heart. There have been more challengers to incumbents than before, with more women, Latinos, and Native Americans running and winning. Half of the challengers using the clean money option say they would not have run without it. Because this system creates more choices, offering fresh faces and new ideas, voter turnout is ratcheting upward. And here's the big one, public financing is working. 59% of Maine's legislators and 36% of those in Arizona have now been elected without taking any tainted money. And publicly funded candidates in Arizona last year won 7 of 9 statewide offices, including the governor and attorney general. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you want clean elections, call Public Campaign, 202-293-0222.
I'll just see who that is then.
Oh no! South American killer bees! They're going for my eye!
A swarm of killer bees. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a better-looking roof with Plitanium plywood from Georgia Pacific. Other roof sheathing materials can swell at the edges, creating an unsightly checkerboard pattern under your shingles. Plitanium roofs provide a more uniform surface. Plitanium plywood. Build it better.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too. But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the situation in the Middle East. No, we're not talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, as we often do on this show. We are talking about the situation in Israel. I want to know whether you think that the killing of Hamas leader Sheikh Yassin was justified or not. I want to know what you think, if anything, can be done to solve the problems between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs. You know, the Chicago Sun-Times wrote an editorial today, and they said, and I'll read from part of it, that in the last 3.5 years alone, according to the Jerusalem Post, 425 Hamas attacks killed 377 Israelis, 288 in suicide bombings, and wounded 2,076. The question perhaps shouldn't be why the Israelis killed the vile Ahmed Yassin on Monday, but why it took them so long to get rid of this mass murderer whose sole goal in life was slaughtering Jews and exterminating the State of Israel. That's a pretty strong statement. That's a pretty strong statement. Why is it that the Palestinians have determined that suicide bombings is the way to fight Israel? Why don't they try a Martin Luther King-like solution? Or is it all Israel's fault? Is Israel at blame for taking Palestinian land and forcing them off and for settlements in the West Bank? I want to hear from you. I'm going to be expressing my views throughout the show, but at first I want to hear what you have to say. And the number to call in is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. I got a caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Nathan, and I'm calling from Rockville, Maryland.
How are you, Nathan?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. And I was calling, actually, well, to make a comment about exactly what you've asked us to, which
sure.
is the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Maybe I've got this all wrong, but I'm going to lay out a scenario to you, and you tell me whether or not you think it's relatively similar.
Okay.
Let's say, hypothetically, that China, for instance, becomes this outrageously overwhelming superpower with technology and weapons that we couldn't possibly hope to match ever. Now, China makes a deal with the Native American tribes, and they say, you know what, the spirit in the sky gave us this land 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years ago, whatever, and we want Manhattan back. And the Chinese say, okay, you know what, if you'll serve our interests, we'll go ahead and make sure that that happens. And they give the Indians all of the weapons, all of these spectacular technologies, and force everybody who's in Manhattan out to New Jersey. Now, I don't know about you, but if I lived in Manhattan and that happened, it wouldn't be very long before I started taking some pretty violent and probably unreasonable action. And
well, can I attack your analogy there?
Israel.
Well, let me see if I can attack your analogy here, okay?
Sure.
Basically, in the Arab world now, there are, I believe, 23, I may be wrong, maybe 26, I know it's in the 20s, mm-hmm. numbers of Arab states. They control a land territory that's larger than the United States of America.
Sure.
Israel controls a territory about the size of New Jersey, speaking of New Jersey. And, in fact, after World War I, when, frankly, Europe wanted to get rid of its Jews, this is even before World War II, they said they made a deal. Jews and Arabs made a deal that because the Arabs didn't control their land either. Actually, at the end of World War I, there were no independent Arab states. Actually, Egypt was there. It was becoming independent of Britain. It wasn't quite independent yet. Most were not. Certainly, there was no Iraq. There was no Saudi Arabia. There was no Jordan or Syria or any of that. After World War One, I mean, this was all controlled by Turkey before World War One, the Ottoman Empire. And
but
I think it's important.
But still a Muslim state.
It was a Muslim state. That's true. It wasn't an Arab state. The Turks were in control. And in fact, the Arabs were very unhappy about being under Turkish rule.
Yeah, but at the core, I think that this is a religious issue, not just about Arabs against Jews.
Okay,
about Muslims against Jews.
What's interesting is that at this time, Jews were already a majority in the city of Jerusalem. A lot of people don't know that. In fact, way back into the 1800s, there were more Jews in Jerusalem than either Christians or Muslims. And that's because Jerusalem, of course, is the holiest city for Jews in the world, much as Rome is to Catholics or Mecca is to Muslims. And the Jews wanted to have a place where they wouldn't be persecuted, where they'd have equal rights. And in fact, they made a deal. Chaim Weizmann, who later became the first president of Israel, made a deal with the father of actually the great-grandfather of today's King Hussein of Jordan, King Abdullah, and they made a deal where Israel would get this small notch called Palestine, which, by the way, at that time included what is today Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, and the Golan Heights. Right. And in return, the Arabs would get the vast territory that is today Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, all the Arabian areas. And they made that deal back then. Now, I'm not saying that this, you know, all the Bedouins of the Arab countries participated in this deal. They didn't. But what's interesting, and I think it's interesting because I think what you express goes back, and that's why I wanted to get into some of the history here. I'll tell you, one of the reasons why I really like radio as opposed to television is in television, if you get a minute of analysis, you know, that's extreme. Maybe I'll make Neil Larry, you'll get 2 minutes. But on radio, we can take the time and really examine the history of this. And so I'm very glad that you raised that question. What I want to do is I want to examine from the beginning. So we have the Jews there making this deal with the Arabs, and they're moving in, and in fact, the League of Nations at the time, it wasn't the United mm-hmm. Nations, the League of Nations decided to set aside Palestine as a home for the Jewish people.
Okay, and the question, though, is the people who are already were they involved in this decision?
Let's talk about that. Cool. To some extent they were, and to some extent they weren't. Largely they weren't, because most of them actually were living on absentee lands. Most of the land, if you go back to Mark Twain's book, The Innocents Abroad in the 1870s, Mark Twain describes going to Palestine at the time. That's what they called it. They called it Palestine. It was a province of Turkey. Said that it was, he said it was a wasteland, basically. That no one was living there, and was basically, you know, he would travel for long periods of time and not see anyone on the roads. And so what happened was the people that lived there were mostly Bedouins. They were mostly wandering through. Interesting, like you mentioned, the American Indians. Much like the American Indians, they would wander through in and out of the lands and travel like shepherds. And there were very few people in the settled population. It was probably under 100,000. So in any case, when Jews moved in there and started to build up the land and drain the swamps and so forth, that helped the Arab populations also moved in for the economics of the area and all, and both moved in. I think, though, the heart of the question is, should the Arabs control every last inch of the Middle East? Or should...
I'm not sure that's it. I mean, they may feel like that as Muslims, but I think that we have to be fair when we say that Israel didn't come in and make an America-style democracy. You know,
well, everyone in Israel can vote
for Jews. You know, Jews are the ones that get to live there. They have the right of return. If you're not a Jew, you don't have certain rights.
Hold on. What right in Israel don't you have if you're a Jew? I agree with you that if you're outside of Israel, then and immigration policies, much as the United States, by the way, often prefers Europeans over Mexicans, we have our own immigration policies. But inside Israel, I mean, I assume you know the Arabs have full right to vote. They have members in parliament. They're active in the labor unions. In fact, I was reading an interesting article about the mayor of Umm al-Fahm. Umm al-Fahm is the largest Arab town in Israel. And Sharon was saying something about maybe returning Umm al-Fahm and giving it to a Palestinian state in the West Bank. And the mayor, this is a very interesting article, I'm going to read you part of it. He's talking with Mayor Sheikh Hashem Abdel Rahman, is the Islamic mayor of the Arab-Israeli town called Umm al-Fahm. By the way, I've been to Umm al-Fahm, and I can tell you that story in a bit. I was there about 15 years ago. And he said that this is the reporter writing, only my question about Ariel Sharon's recent suggestions to incorporate Umm al-Fahm into a future Palestine disrupts the festive atmosphere. Quote, are we not citizens of this state, he asks. I have relatives all over this country. You want to put a border between us? That's the ultimate racism, the ultimate Holocaust. He says, believe me, it's just politics. It's never going to happen. But as the reporter prepares to leave, he asks me anxiously, Do you think Sharon is serious? What's interesting is that these 40,000 Arabs in Umm al-Fahm who live in Israel and who have Israeli citizenship and who have the right to vote and, frankly, who live much better than their Palestinian neighbors, they don't want to live in a Palestinian state. They're very happy living in Israel. Well, I can't say they're very happy. I'm sure they have problems with the state of Israel. But they understand that their life is better in a democratic state that's majority Jewish than living in a Palestinian state. I guess the point I wanted to make on the history, though, is that, I mean, the question is, I guess, whether you are conceding Israel has a right to exist or not. I mean, well, that's sort of the heart of the question.
There is a big question about that because, you know, I mean, no other group in the world, and I don't think that I'd be exaggerating if I said that at one time or another throughout the course of history, every people on earth has been attacked, enslaved, and beaten, oppressed by some other people. You know what I mean? But we seem to say, like, the Jews have had this incredible, persistent oppression for many millennia, and therefore they deserve this.
So have others, the Kurds, for example.
Just for them.
Well, so have others.
And we're going to kick out everybody who's already living there.
Well, first of all, who told you Israel kicked out anybody? I mean, let's just be very clear on this.
Well,
I was
under the impression that those people living in refugee camps out on the West Bank, that they used to live in Israel. Now, I could be wrong about that.
Well, no. Some of them, many of them did. In fact, it's very interesting what happened in 1947-48. In 48, there was a let me give you an example, I think, an historical example. When India and Pakistan used to be one nation, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, you may well know, were all part of British India. And you had Hindus and Muslims all living together and not necessarily getting along. And when Pakistan split off from India after India became an independent state, there were some 26 million people who transferred, Hindus who were living in what became Pakistan who went to India, and Muslims who didn't want to live in India and a Hindu state who went to Pakistan. What's interesting is the exact same thing happened when Israel formed in 1948. There were 600,000 Palestinian Arabs who, for whatever reason, and we can discuss that if you want, left the state of Israel and went to Jordan and Egypt, where the Arab countries were. And at the same time, 800,000 Jews were kicked out of Arab countries. For example, I don't know if you know your Bible, Jews have been living in Iraq since the Babylonian exile. Iraq is Babylonia. Babylonia is the ancient name.
Well, so I'm not arguing that that's the right thing to do, to exile, you know, anybody from any place. Well, I'm just saying that two wrongs don't make a right.
No, but here's the question. Here's the question. Israel at the time had less than 1 million people. They basically took in and their they doubled their population. In those first 2 years, you had about 800,000 Jews taking in about 600,000 Jews from Arab countries across the globe. And again, they'd lived in those countries for thousands of years, got no compensation for their property. Many were killed. They left for their lives. At the same time, you have about 600,000 Palestinians leaving the territory that became Israel, and the Arab states did not allow them to become citizens. They put them in refugee camps. I mean, who built the refugee camps? Israel never built a single refugee camp. The ones in Gaza were built by Egypt, which took over Gaza, which was supposed to be a Palestinian state, and Jordan took over the West Bank, which was supposed to be a Palestinian state, put the Palestinians in refugee camps, did not allow them to become citizens. What's interesting is that Israel treats its Arab citizens, the ones that live in Israel, far better than I know of any Arab country treating the Palestinians. The Palestinians have been spit on by everybody. And I think, arguably, they've been spit on more by their fellow Arab countries than even by Israel. And I'm not saying they have it good. I'm not saying those refugee camps are good. They're not good at all. But I do think it's important to have a sense of history, because this idea that Israel came in and kicked everyone out, I just don't think that's a nuanced story. I don't think that tells the full story.
Well, I think that you're right. What's disturbing is that, you know, this is not a story that we ever learned in high school, in any of our public education. We never heard a word about Israel. I don't remember it anyway. Did you get it?
Well, I fully admit my bias. I am Jewish, and I learned much of this in studying in school. Also, I've been to this issue, including the original League of Nations documents, including the Arab countries that said Palestinian. Well, they didn't say Palestinians because that word wasn't used at the time. Palestinians is actually a very new term. It's only about 40 years old. But
right.
They said, Arabs, leave Israel so that we can come in. We're going to kill everyone in their path, and you don't want to be in the way, and I can show you the broadcast from the Arab nations. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, frankly, the Arabs that stayed in Israel got a pretty good thing. They're like the people in Umm al-Farm. I'm not saying that they live gloriously, but I mean they live a lot better than
average Western citizen.
Yeah, they live a lot better than just about any Arab in an Arab country that's not a sheikh or a royal family. Because, you know, I mean, Israel is not as rich as Europe, but it has basic education and, you know, sanitary conditions, and they do have the right to vote. They do have members of parliament. I guess wanted to go into the history, but I think that part of the problem is that history almost becomes beside the point. Is that people have, you know, Palestinians feel they have this ancient grievance. Jews feel they have an ancient grievance. Everyone has a grievance. And
see, that's just the point, though, is like these folks, they have an ancient grievance, and nobody's saying that that isn't true. All I'm saying is that, you know, the entire world has been slaughtered and warred on and invaded and moved around, and, you know, most of us seem to have gotten over our ancient grievances.
I think here's my solution.
You don't see the French up in arms still trying to get descendants of the old aristocracy to, you know, even old scores.
Well, you do see conflicts between Catholics and Protestants still in Northern Ireland today. They've calmed down a bit, I think. And I think the reason they've calmed down in Northern Ireland in the last 10, 20 years is because people realize that armed conflict was not going to solve the problem. Here's my solution, I guess, for displaced peoples. Give them a state, all right? The Jews should have a state. I support a Palestinian state. I think the Kurds, by the way, in northern Iraq, should have a state. I disagree with the Bush administration and the former Clinton administration that wants to include them in Iraq. They are a separate people. They've been persecuted by Iraq, Iran, Syria, the former Soviet Union. They should have a state of their own, one Kurdish
Turkey?
State.
Yeah, at
Turkey, too. Turkey, too, absolutely. Absolutely. Turkey definitely persecuted them. And I think the answer is, let me talk about the Kurds because I think it's instructive. And by the way, if you want to join in this conversation, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. I think the Kurds is instructive because their situation, this is Mark Levine's proposal. I don't know anyone that's tried it, but I think the Kurds would be very happy at having an independent state of their own, even if it was a small percentage of their ancient lands, which include, like I said, parts of Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey, and the former Soviet Union. Now, Turkey is very nervous about a Kurdish state. They have said things to the administration. They're very upset by the possibility because they're afraid that a Kurdish state would take over former Turkish lands. Here's my solution, the Mark Levine solution. My solution is this. You'd say to the Kurds, you're going to get an independent state if you agree to forever forswear any territorial designs on ancient Kurdish lands outside of the state we're going to give you in northern Iraq. Now look at what this does. It says to the Kurds, you get an independent state, all right? You get an independent state, you get to control your destiny, you get to control your lives. You're not under the thumbprint of Saddam Hussein or Turkey or Syria or anyone. And it says to Turkey, your borders, even though they include some ancient Kurdish lands, we're going to protect your borders. And the same to the other states in the region. To me, this is a way of saying every people should get a state. But not two or three or four states. Everyone people should get one state to control their destiny, build a big wall, a fence, if you like, and then, you know, let's leave people alone. I think the same thing should happen to the Palestinians. When Barak offered Arafat 95% of the West Bank and 100% of Gaza in 2000 in Camp David with Clinton watching, I think Arafat did not serve his people well in not only rejecting the offer, but not giving a counteroffer and, you know, and starting a bunch of terrorist attacks. I mean, why is it that a people who's been oppressed so long as the Palestinians would not accept 95% of what they want and decide instead to start sending out their children to kill people? That mentality I don't understand.
I think that there may be some power play from the Palestinian Authority. I mean, if they have to hunker down and actually adhere to a legitimate system, they're definitely going to lose power.
I agree with
you.
So,
you know, a state is not really in their interest, and we ought not to be looking to that leadership form one.
Well, good. We have an agreement here. I completely agree with you. I think that the Palestinians have been badly treated by their leadership, and I'm hopeful. And it may take 10, 20, 30 years. My belief, and I want to hear, you know, what other callers have to think at 877-577-SCOOP. But my belief is that one day there will be a Palestinian leader like a Martin Luther King, like a Mahatma Gandhi that says, you know what, I don't like the Israelis in certain territories, but we're going to try a peaceful solution. Just try it. Try it for 2 years. March in the streets, do protests. I think the whole world would come around. I think the United States would come around. And most importantly, Israel, which is a democracy, I think the Israeli people would come around if they truly tried peace instead of strapping on these weapons to children and sending them to kill people, which I don't think helps anyone.
Well, I think that you're right about that, but I think that we have to admit that these folks are acting in natural ways. They feel like they're oppressed. They're obviously at a socioeconomic disadvantage. They're at a military disadvantage. You know, I mean, they don't have any of the guns or missiles, helicopters that we provide Israel with.
Well, they have guns, actually. They were given guns.
But they don't have the sort of state-of-the-art weaponry regularly.
So why don't they try
peace?
Military.
Like, I mean, if Palestine and Israel, if you could argue that they had equal militaries, there would be no need for suicide bombers. They're trying to attain some goal, and I'm not saying that their tactics are legitimate, saying that their reactions are natural.
Yeah, well, see, I don't see it as natural, because to me, when you're outgunned, okay, the natural reaction is to try peace, to just try. If Arafat had disarmed the terrorists,
I don't think that's true, because, you know, you oppress people, and we've seen it throughout the course of history, that, you know, people will acquiesce for a time under the gun, but there's always going to be a time of reckoning. There will always
really?
Be a revolution.
Do you think the Native Americans will have a revolution against us?
Well, okay, with the exception of committing genocide.
Well, African Americans
will always
rise up
against the Lord.
Let's talk about African Americans. We white people in America, we enslaved them. We viciously treated them. We lynched. I mean, I say we. Obviously, I'm talking about white Americans before I was born. But even into the 60s, you know, segregation and no right to vote. There is no question that America has horribly, horribly mistreated the slaves and descendants of slaves. And you could argue that black people should have a right to rise up and have a terrorist faction and all of that. And yet what Martin Luther King did was he said, you know what, despite all the horror and lynching and slavery and all the horrible things white people did to black people for hundreds of years in America, we're going to strive for equality. We're going to strive to just have equal rights.
Again, I didn't say that what they're doing is right. I'm saying that the reaction is natural. I mean, when a person is faced with violence, at least when somebody hits me in the face, I'm not the type of jack to turn the other cheek. You know,
but
I mean,
look at the
maybe
difference between what the Palestinians are doing, though, and what the Israelis are doing. The Israelis are going after leaders. They're going after killers, people like...
That's because they have the power to do that. They have the technology to do that. I would recommend seeing a film that our government has been showing counterintelligence experts about terrorism. It was at the AFI Silver here in D.C. recently. It's called The Battle of Algiers. It's a French movie about their occupation of Algiers and about the terrorist action that happened there. And one gentleman made a fantastic point, and I think it's a valid point. He said, look, you know what? We'll stop using bombs if you'll just trade us all of your Air Force carriers, your nuclear-powered submarines, all of your satellites, all of your, you know, I mean...
But Nathan,
we'll
let me ask you something.
We'll stop using bombs as soon as you trade all of that stuff.
Let me ask you something. Is the goal of the Palestinians, in your mind, to kill Jews and to destroy the existence of Israel, or is their goal to have a state and live in peace? What do you think is their goal? Because if their goal is to destroy Israel, then they want all those weapons.
I think the goal of the leadership is to destroy Israel.
Nathan, we entirely agree. We entirely agree. I think the leaders want to destroy Israel. I think some Palestinians want peace. Some people don't. I don't understand families that send their kids off to be suicide bombers, frankly. I think they're just wacko parents.
I'm not disagreeing
I know you're not.
I can understand how a terribly frustrating situation can boil to a point like this, and people will behave this way because they feel they have no other option.
Well,
and if you look at the balance of power, it's vastly weighted toward the Israelis. You know, there's no question about it. They've got the vastly larger military force.
Right, but see, what I don't understand
is it capability. You know, I mean,
I understand, Nathan.
If the Palestinians had that capability, maybe they'd be shooting Sharon.
Right, but Nathan,
so
that's my point.
Can.
That's my point. If they had more power, they would do more death and destruction. It seems to me that the right option for the Palestinians is just to try, just once, not death and destruction. Abba Iban, a very liberal, very left, if you will, Israeli leader, once said...
Let me say this.
They said the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And what I'm saying is, instead of fighting Israel on the battlefield, fight their hearts and minds. Israel is a democracy. Show them that you can live in peace. If Arafat had taken Barak's offer, 95% of the West Bank, they'd have a state right now. Hey, Nathan, I got to go to a commercial. Do you want to hang on after the break?
You know what? I'll let somebody
else. Okay. Let someone else go.
Thanks a lot for your time, though,
Thank
Mark.
You.
I
appreciate talking with you. We got a lot of people holding on the line. I promise I'll get to all of you. But first, we got to go to a commercial break. And we'll be back with more of this discussion over what's going on in Israel right after these messages.
Local unions in Illinois, Pennsylvania, Colorado, and Tennessee voted to support a strike after their current contract expires at midnight on March 31st. Caterpillar announced they have contingency plans similar to what they used during the mid-1990s strike to replace the packaging, shipping, and distribution workers and make sure customers continue receiving their products on time.
More than 3,000 workers employed by a major corporate farmer in California stand to gain millions of dollars in back pay thanks to a federal judge's ruling. It involves the D'Arrigo Brothers Company of Salinas and its use of company buses to haul farm workers to and from vegetable fields in need of harvest. Travel to the fields typically takes an hour or longer each day. The companies refuse to pay the workers for the time they've spent on their buses. The judge says they should have been paid. He'll determine the damage award on April 5th.
UAW members are upset in Chicago. The majority of workers at a Ford Motor Company's Chicago assembly plant signed a petition to the UAW International calling for a new contract election. UAW Local 551 is claiming widespread voter fraud tainted their March 16th election, contending their voter ledger books didn't add up, the ballot box wasn't locked, and it was left in an unsecured location.
Tokyo's Board of Education says it will discipline teachers who displayed unpatriotic behavior at high school graduations earlier this month. The board approved controversial rules late last year that require all teachers to stand and sing Japan's national anthem anytime it's played at a school-related event. For the graduation ceremonies, the board reportedly sent inspectors to make sure teachers complied. At least 150 did not. There is a pending lawsuit challenging the rule, and for now the board will probably just warn the teachers about the consequences of further unpatriotic displays, although a second violation may mean dismissal. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Last month's tepid employment report was bad enough. A total of 21,000 new jobs were created in February when the experts expected six times that number. But that only counts new full or part-time hires. The majority of job growth actually took place in the temp market, where 32,000 new jobs were reported for February. Higher growth in temping over long-term employment is troubling, even more so if sustained.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We are talking about the situation in the Middle East. No, not Iraq, not Afghanistan this time. We're talking about the situation in Israel and the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians and the recent Israeli assassination of Hamas leader Sheikh Yassin. I want to know if you think this was justified. The Europeans, many of them say that it was illegal. Do you think it was justified? Do you think the whole Israeli state is justified? I just had a very interesting discussion with Nathan of Rockville, Maryland, where we talked about the history of the State of Israel. I want to hear from you. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. And in the second hour, we're going to talk about the inside scoop with what's going on in Congress. But now, let's talk about Israel. Caller, what's your first name and where are you from?
Hey, Mark, this is Don in Atlanta.
Hey, Don in Atlanta. How are you, sir?
Doing great. It's good you're taking on such complex issues.
I'm trying.
You know, on most talk radio, it's just the bumper sticker mentality, get your point in and get off. But, you know, you give it time to develop. Your former caller, I was going to mention that same movie, The Battle of Algiers. The reason I think the Palestinians have taken on this is because that's the way the French were forced out of Algiers, and I think they've been following that almost like a script. But, you know, you mentioned give peace a chance. Well, there wasn't much suicide bombing historically in the last 30 years until, what, the last 5 or 6 years were the worst, maybe even less time than that. There was in the 80s when Prime Minister Rabin was in there. There was a great economy and virtually no suicide bombings. So I'm not so sure peace is going to work either.
Well, okay, let me deal with your points because I think you make a bunch of good ones, Don. First of all, in terms of Algiers, I think the Palestinians need to understand the difference between Israel and France. France was occupying a land where the French had no natural ties, where there was no, you know, the French were returning home to Algeria. They were colonial. It would be much more example of Iraq trying to kick out all the Kurds of Iraq who live there and have lived there a lot of time. And I think that one of the reasons, in fact, why Sharon killed the leader of Hamas was to say that when he withdraws from Gaza, and by the way, I support the withdrawal from Gaza. I think that's a good idea. It shouldn't be seen as a weakness, as it was often seen. You know, everyone said Israel should get out of Lebanon, where they were protecting right. Their northern border, and then they left and attacks stepped up. And so I think it's important that Israel leave with strength. I do want to go to your other point, though, the point about the 80s. There was a lot more peace in the 80s, and Rabin began the Oslo Accords in Oslo, Norway, which many of us remember. And, of course, the heart of the Oslo Accords was that it would bring the PLO, Yasser Arafat's group, which had been exiled in Tunis. And remember, the Palestinians didn't have guns then. There was an intifada fought mostly with stones. And, in fact, got a lot of world support, even got a lot of Israeli support. And
the good old days, in other words.
Well, you know, I mean, it's one – frankly, I wish they'd done, like I said, nonviolent protests, because I think that would have gotten even more Israeli support, even more world support. Israel couldn't have helped but give them a state then. But then when Oslo came back and they brought back the PLO, and the PLO was going to stop the extremists. They were going to stop Hamas and the terrorism, and in return, they would get a state. They'd get a state of their own, and things were going along just fine. And, of course, the denouement, right, the conclusion, the climax, was Camp David 2000, where you had Clinton, and I think Bill Clinton bent over backwards to try to solve this problem.
Here's two reasons that Arafat had problems with. In fact, you know, they've always reported that it may have been his suicide by his own people had he signed the recent accords, even though he's going to give them, like you said, 95% of what they sought. Surely much better than what they're going to get today
with nothing.
A wall or fence being
exactly.
built. They don't get nearly as much.
Exactly.
Maybe I've read 40%, but here's the problems. He had two problems. One, the Palestinian state would have been divided into four quadrants, which would have been difficult to connect. You could only have to go through Israeli checkpoints.
No, wait, that's not true, Don. You know, I got to tell you, I've heard that said. It's simply not true. And I ask you to go, and in fact, if you like, I'll put a map on my website, radioinsidescoop.com. It's not there now. It shows the Barak plan. You know, Palestinians have said that, but I've seen the maps. And in fact, so have the Clinton officials. Now Gaza was separated from the West Bank, but
right.
all of the West Bank was completely contiguous. You could get to it without going through any Israeli checkpoints.
Maybe that's what hardcore President Clinton bargaining did. Maybe he eliminated that. Maybe it was a bigger problem earlier on. The second point, though, that Arafat had was from a religious standpoint. Even though he's certainly not a religious man, but from the religious standpoint, he would have been giving up too much of East Jerusalem, and I'm not too sure. That could have been accepted.
You know, Clinton, and I was very surprised when Barak offered this. Jerusalem, after being taken in 1967, of course, Jerusalem was always a majority Jewish city way back into the 1800s. But when Israel, and of course, in 1948, the Jordanian army came in, kicked all the Jews out of East Jerusalem, physically forced them out, took the gravestones, made nice latrines out of them. Real, real sweet Jordanian army back then. When Israel came back and conquered the old city, a bill passed in the Israeli Knesset, the Israeli parliament, saying that Jerusalem would be forever unified, forever part of the state of Israel. I was shocked when Barak, elected leader, prime minister of Israel, actually offered to re-divide Jerusalem, to give East Jerusalem
right.
back to the Arabs. And he even offered, and this really shocked me, and frankly, I don't know if the Israeli people would have stood up to it, but he even offered in one of the last negotiations to give up the holiest place in all of Judaism, the Temple Mount, which is as holy as the Vatican in Rome or the Kaaba in Mecca, the black... this is the holiest place in all... But it's holy to Muslims, too, because they built a mosque and a shrine on top of the Temple Mount. He offered to allow the Palestinians to control the Temple Mount. The Jews would control actually the archaeological ruins below. I was shocked that he went that far. And even then, Arafat not only didn't accept the offer, he didn't give a counteroffer.
Right.
He
I think it was way too late at that point, but I agree that was
my point is this.
Concessions, no question about it. That was a true step toward peace. But you mentioned going back to the 1860s. Now,
yeah.
The French were in Algiers since 1840, so they were deeply rooted there. But
that's
you're
true.
Right, it wasn't their home, and they realized at some point they're going to have to leave. But
Holocaust survivors had no place to go to. I mean, Poland certainly was killing them, didn't want them back. You know, it's kind of hard to say go back to Germany when all their homes have been taken or now living in by good Nazis. I mean, the Jews literally had no place to go to. And when you don't have a place to go to, you tend to fight a lot more. What surprised me is why Jordan, which of course is the eastern part of Palestine, it's the part that was always traditionally eastern Palestine, Israel was western Palestine, why Jordan hasn't accepted Palestinians. I know a number of them have become citizens of Jordan,
right.
But if they weren't put in refugee camps, I'm convinced that no one would even notice today. Populations transfer all the time.
I think the probable reason is that they're a political football for Jordan. Now
I think that's right.
They can use them on the world stage. Look at these people living in squalor.
I think
if
that's right.
If they make them citizens of Jordan, they become Jordan's responsibility, and it certainly takes away their reasons for war because it's up to Jordan to share their wealth and bring up their life standards and that type thing. Because, in other words, they don't want the burden of citizens who I guess probably couldn't produce that much. But, you know, you'd mentioned the American Native, and I thought it's interesting that the American Native is, of course, the poorest people in this country, and, of course, they've been put on reservations. You might compare that to refugee camps. But also,
that's why I support the casinos. It's a great way for them to finally get something back.
I know. It's a shame it has to be that way, but if that really works. But it seems like both of them, though, had ended up living in squalor and destitution on refugee camps, whether it's the Palestinians or the American Natives. But one point was mentioned earlier about the Israeli army being so much bigger and stronger than Palestine. I think the previous caller needs to realize Israel is not building that army just for Palestine. The whole Middle East has been hostile historically to Israel, so
right.
They have to have an army to protect
right.
from 23 nations of some 230 million Arabs out there that have expressed extreme hostility. So you have to have a nuclear weapons. You have to have strong armies. Otherwise, those invasions would have kept coming. So I think it only makes sense to balance it off. And I agree. I mean, what is it, 5 or 6 million Israelis right now?
About 5 million.
About 5 million versus over 230 million Arabs in that region.
Yep.
It was hard scrabble land, was worthless. In fact, now, if Palestine was ever paid for that land, fair market value, they'd be getting much more than it would have ever been worth with them owning it to have any kind of concession. So I do think, I'd like to get your opinion on this. It seems to me that the old bull, Prime Minister General Sharon, used his sumo-like weight and outmaneuvered our president. Now, you know, I think before the roadmap could have been moved forward, Saddam had to be removed because, again, there were those weapons up there, and he was a menace to the region. So I think Prime Minister Sharon indicated until he's gone, there's going to be no movement of the roadmap. And now that President Bush has gone in and taken out Saddam and we got the troops in there, the roadmap is dead.
Well, I'm not sure what you said on Iraq. My view is that I don't think the Iraq war was justified. I think Sharon is he's certainly a cagey guy. He's certainly
experience for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and let me be clear. I think he did some horrible things back in the 80s at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps out in Lebanon. But in essence, to me, Sharon is not the problem because to me he is a result, not a cause. The Israelis elected him. They tried Barak. They tried peace, and when Arafat showed them that he wasn't going to give peace, even if they offered everything, then I think the Israelis turned to Sharon. I think, I really believe, and I think some cagey Palestinians should try it. I really believe if the Palestinians would stop the terrorist bombings, stop the terrorist attacks, and say, you know what, you know, hell, we'll take 50% of the West Bank.
But that
take
can't
something.
For this reason, Hamas is dedicated to the destruction of Israel.
They are.
It's not about the land, it's about all the land.
That's true.
So to me, until you have a viable Palestinian state, if those people have something to live for, they won't have the reason to get rid of Hamas. But if Hamas threatens their new statehood, you see,
interesting.
You could have Israel,
well, you know, we'll see when
the new Palestinian government, the United States, could have troops there, and whoever got out of line, it could be handled harshly. But, you know, I don't understand why General Sharon, though, has opposed United States, English, and even UN troops into the divider zone between Israel and Palestine. Wouldn't that be a solution to getting the violence down?
I don't know that we want American troops there, frankly, as an American. I'm not so sure that we want them there. I know why Israel... I don't know that Israel would oppose U.S. troops.
No, I think it's policy not to allow them in. I think we tried... I know the U.N. Wanted to go in and was not allowed.
Yeah, that's true. There's a big distinction. By the way, the United States is involved right now in Sinai, patrolling some of the borders between Israel and Egypt. I know that. So Israel has allowed the U.S. in. The reason they don't want to allow the U.N. in is because the United Nations has shown, and this is another historical thing, and then I got to get to other callers, Don. But the United Nations in the past, when they were in Egypt after the 56 war, as soon as Nasser, Egyptian leader, wanted them out, they left. When the United Nations came in Lebanon to block the area, what the Hezbollah terrorists would do is they'd actually use the UN trucks as cover and shoot from behind them and make Israel lob missiles over them. The United Nations, I remember because I was actually up in Lebanon in the 80s, and I saw, you know, all the UN soldiers. They did nothing at best, and at worst, they actually helped the terrorists. And so I can understand why Israel wouldn't want the UN there. Now, the U.S., I think Israel would want, but as an American, I'm not sure I do. Hey, Don, I got to get to other callers.
Okay.
But I
want to
thank you very much for joining in and for talking to me on the show. You know, it's interesting to me the point that Don made about American natives. I do believe that Native Americans have been profoundly mistreated in America. Some by force. I mean, we definitely took Native American lands. Others by white man's diseases that killed them in massive numbers. I sincerely believe we need some sort of reparations. That's why, frankly, I support, and I'm very glad that some very clever Native American thought of doing the casinos. Because I think what the casinos do is they give them a chance to reclaim their lives, to get some of the wealth that was taken from them. If Native Americans, though, ever started to do a terrorist group, ever started to strap bombs on themselves and try to blow up American malls, even though I think what America did to the American natives is far worse than anything Israel's done to the Palestinians. It's horrible if you look at our past. Nevertheless, if a Native American started doing terrorist attacks against American children, I would be as vehemently opposed to them as I am to Hamas and the PLO. Let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your name and where are you from? Caller? Did I lose you? Caller, last chance. All right, let's go on to another caller. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your name and where are you from?
I'm Nathan. I'm in San Francisco.
Nathan in San Francisco, what do you think of this debate?
Well, I'm really interested to see what you have to say about the Camp David Accord, because everything I've been able to find has said that basically it turned the Palestinian state into Oz, like the HBO show, a fully enclosed set of four areas that had even its...
Where did you hear that, Nathan? Because I've seen the maps, and the maps don't show that. I'm curious to know where you heard that, because you didn't hear that from Bill Clinton or from any of his people, did you?
No.
This is Palestinian...
trying to do research, and from what I've seen, the only map that was ever presented during the talks, not drawn afterwards from comments, and actually had the security zone along the eastern border. So I know that I got that at some point off a PBS website. They had drawn maps of the various agreements that were having proposed, and
PBS.
I've also seen the same map or a similar map elsewhere.
You know what I'd like you to do? Send me an email to mark@radioinsidescoop.com. I'm going to put on my website, when this program is done, the maps that I've seen that Clinton officials say were the maps proposed at Camp David. And I think that you'd have every reason to mistrust, you know, what the Israelis say or what the Palestinians say. But I think that Clinton was a fair broker. And there were no, Gaza was separate from the West Bank. But the West Bank was a fully contiguous site. You could travel from one area to the other without going through Israeli checkpoints. In fact, Barak even proposed, I remember, an incredibly expensive elevated highway, a bridge, if you will, from Gaza to the West Bank with no stops. You could actually travel from the Gaza to the West Bank. There were no exits on this 25-mile highway. You actually could travel from one to the other, and that was part of the plan. So the idea that it was separated into four things, I've heard that recently, and I'd really like to know your source. I'd like to see the PBS.
Well, I believe it wasn't that land belonged to Israel. I believe, in theory, the land belonged to the Palestine state. But I believe that Israel reserved the right to patrol those areas for its own security. So so that an invading force could not move into Palestine and then move into Israel. And it was, in effect, I think, a prison state where the prisoners were allowed to rule themselves. But, yeah, I'll send you the information I have.
Send me what you have, because
what you guys have.
That hasn't been my understanding. Go ahead. By the way, let me ask you about the phone number one more time. Yep.
If the things that I have seen are correct, I understand completely why they walked away from the deal, because it was not a deal in good faith. It was not a deal to give them a state. It was a deal to put them in a prison where Israel no longer had responsibility for their lives and death.
Well, now, you call it a prison, but, what's interesting to me is that, you know, what really strikes me is when people say, oh, well, you know, they were going to be in their own country, and I hear Palestinians say today, isn't it awful when Israel closes the checkpoints and doesn't let Palestinian workers who are just trying to feed their families come in and work in Israel? And then they go in, they open the checkpoints, and what happens? 99% of the Palestinians come in to try to work in Israel, and 1% come in with bombs and try to massacre every man, woman, and child they can. And so then Israel closes the checkpoints, and they say, hey, this is our livelihood. It seems to me that the Palestinians can't have it both ways. Either they want to be part of the Israeli economy, like the mayor of Umm al-Fahm, the Israeli Arabs that have full and equal rights in Israel, or they want their own state, and it's going to be poor, and they're just going to have to have their own economy. But they can't have it both ways. They can't say, we want to be able to work in Israel, and at the same time, we want to be able to have terrorist attacks in Israel. I mean, I can understand why Israel's closing its borders.
A friend of mine who was actually worked there for a couple years in the military or the police so he could be a citizenship, have his Israeli citizenship while he still lives here and vote in their things and so on, I believe, he told me that they actively disrupt the rise of heavy industry in Palestine because they're afraid it will be used to make weapons. So Israel destroys the Palestinian economy and then will not let them work in Israel.
So why
they can't have it both ways either. Either they need to let people reliably get to work, or they need to stop disrupting the economy.
How about a better idea?
To avoid weapons.
How about we build a big fence? Israel builds a big fence, and Israel lives in Israel, and the Palestinians live in the West Bank and Gaza. And Sharon's going to unilaterally withdraw from Gaza, even though the Palestinians are not offering to put down their weapons. They've still promised to try and kill every Jew in Israel. Still, Sharon has said, and I hope he will, leave Gaza as a start and give them a state on their own. And then, you know, they have their own state. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Sharon has said a lot of things over the years. I would put absolutely no faith. Actions over words, and we've seen basically no action.
Right, and you don't put any faith in Arafat either, do you?
No.
Okay,
no.
All right, just
but
to be
I
fair.
I don't even think of Arafat as their leader anymore. I think of them as a bunch of, you know, starved, poor people who sometimes get to work, sometimes don't, and are more or less beat up by someone who has all the money and international support, a.k.a. the U.S. And my tax dollars. That's what pisses me off.
Well, when you say it has all
human rights abuses on my tax dollars.
When you say all the international support, I actually think most of the international support supports the Arab world because they want Arab oil. But why don't Arab countries take care of Palestinians? Why don't they feed them, take care of them, take them in, allow them to become citizens? Why did Egypt and Jordan build these refugee camps and insist that they couldn't become citizens when Israel has opened its land to Jews that have been persecuted and mistreated in Arab countries? Why do you think that is?
Because by taking those citizens, they would taking those people in and letting them be citizens in their country, they would have ended this problem. They
exactly.
would have basically condoned Israel pushing these people off their land.
Why is it their land?
You know,
well, hold on.
Why? In the history books, you can find that every racial group controlled everything at some point, and you kind of need to start in the modern era.
Why do you consider land that individual Jews purchased to be Palestinian land? I'm being clear, because at the time of Israel's foundation, there were 70% of the land was empty. It was basically owned by Great Britain, who got it from Turkey. I mean, most of this land, most of the West Bank, in fact, still today, is empty. It's very beautiful hills in the desert, actually. So that 70% of the land that nobody owned, why would you consider it Palestinian land rather than Israeli land?
What I do consider is that it's a lot like the Louisiana Purchase. Just because we were able to buy a big chunk of the U.S. from the French doesn't mean the Native Americans who are living there didn't actually own it. I think it's a similar situation.
Should we give it back?
And yes, a lot of that land was empty, but they were also, to a large extent, the Native Americans were nomads. Well, they moved across their lands and lived off a large piece of land.
As I said, I agree with you that we profoundly mistreated Native Americans. I can see that point. What do you think should be done now? Should there be a Native American state in the United States?
No. I mean,
why not?
We're going along the same lines. I think we need to give them more freedom on their own land. I believe
I agree.
We should give them the rights of states, not somewhere between a state and a county, which is where they seem to be right now. But that's kind of a separate issue. I just brought it up because we did buy a bunch of the U.S. from the French, just like the way individual Jews were able to buy large chunks
by absentee landowners
occupied Palestine from the English. But that doesn't mean it was the English's to sell. I mean, you could sell me the Brooklyn Bridge. It doesn't mean it's yours to sell.
What's interesting,
I could buy it from you.
You know what's interesting is actually most of the land, 70%, as I said, was just state land. Most of the private land that was purchased by absentee landowners. They were mostly Egyptian and Syrian, and the Palestinians that were living there were working there, but they didn't own the land. It's actually a very interesting historical point. Hey, Nathan, thanks very much for your call. I got to go to a commercial. We're going to continue this discussion because I think it's a really good one. If you want to call in and join in the debate, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And then we're going to go on and talk about the inside scoop as to what's going on in Congress. We'll be back with more of the inside scoop and your calls right after these messages.
Citizens' efforts to reform America's money-corrupted political process, saying it's as futile as trying to teach table manners to a hog. The effort wears you out, and it only annoys the hog. That's cute, but if the cynics would only lift their eyes from their myopic focus on Washington, they would see something big taking place in such diverse states as Maine and Arizona. Citizens in both places have already passed grassroots initiatives providing for dramatic reform, public financing of elections. These clean election initiatives give candidates of any party the chance to finance both their primary and general election campaigns with public funds, provided they forego taking special interest money. Not only does this help get corrupt money out of the process, but it also means a regular person can run for office again, since a school teacher, taxi driver, farmer, shopkeeper, steelworker, or anyone else has access to a pool of money to make them financially competitive with the incumbents. Maine and Arizona have run two election cycles under clean money laws, and the results would warm the cockles of the coldest cynic's heart. There have been more challengers to incumbents than before, with more women, Latinos, and Native Americans running and winning. Half of the challengers using the clean money option say they would not have run without it. Because this system creates more choices, offering fresh faces and new ideas, voter turnout is ratcheting upward. And here's the big one, public financing is working. 59% of Maine's legislators and 36% of those in Arizona have now been elected without taking any tainted money. And publicly funded candidates in Arizona last year won 7 of 9 statewide offices, including the governor and attorney general. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you want clean elections, call Public Campaign, 202-293-0222.
I'll just see who that is then.
Oh no! South American killer bees! They're going for my eye!
A swarm of killer bees. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a better-looking roof with Plitanium plywood from Georgia-Pacific. Other roof sheathing materials can swell at the edges, creating an unsightly checkerboard pattern under your shingles. Plitanium roofs provide a more uniform surface. Plitanium plywood. Build it better.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
I'm falling to the sky. Oh.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're dealing with a pretty controversial topic, the topic of Israel and the Palestinians. As most of you know, usually what I do is I talk about what the Bush administration is doing, and in fact, I do want to give the Inside Scoop at the end of this hour on some of the stuff that's going on in Congress, some of the stuff the Republicans are doing. Tomorrow, we're going to have a show dealing entirely with the 9/11 Commission. We're going to talk about the really tremendous revelations of Richard Clark, some of the stuff that I've reported in the past. But now we have an insider letting us know that Bush really wasn't watching 9/11. Right now, though, we're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The number to call in is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. It's a toll-free number, and we've really had a great discussion, I think, on the air so far. You can also send me an email if you want. You're probably more likely to get on if you call, but if you can send an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. I do want to read some of these emails I've received. There's Cindy from the Northwest. She says regarding Yassin, that would be the Hamas terrorist leader that Israel just assassinated. She says, I think the method used to kill him was insane. The mental picture of a man in a wheelchair hit by a rocket attack boggles the mind. Even though the man in the wheelchair is a murderer too, the men who killed him went insane. I think the government of Israel has been losing it. I don't know the answer, but I have always been pro-Israel. I am a Democrat. I remember when Arafat was regarded internationally as a rather small terrorist, not a head of state. Terrorism sure worked for him. How can anyone not think the Palestinians wouldn't notice that? Well, that's a very interesting email. I guess my view, I'm not sure whether killing Yassin was a good strategic move or not. I guess I have an open mind on that. I think it may be, because I think it may mean that people are starting to realize if they head terrorist groups, they're not going to live very long. On the other hand, whether or not it was a good idea, and it may not have been, I clearly think it was justified. And I think your point, Cindy, that Arafat is now regarded as the head of state, well, that's true, and I think that's largely what happens when you give in to terrorism. And that's why, you know, I wouldn't support giving in to terrorism here. Again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. I do want to read one more email, and then I'll get to your calls. This is from Karen. She doesn't say where she's writing from. She says, state-sponsored assassinations is wrong. Whether it is Israel killing a Hamas leader or W asking for bin Laden dead or alive, should these men be brought to justice? Absolutely. But I don't believe in the death penalty, especially without a trial. In my opinion, both the Republicans and Democrats fighting on TV this week over who was more likely to kill bin Laden is disgraceful. How do I explain this to my children? Gandhi was right. Well, Karen, I think that's a very interesting point. I would agree with you, by the way, that it would be preferable to put a man like a Hamas leader or Osama bin Laden on trial to show, to prove to the world that they've done what they've said they've done, what they've been I mean, of course, I guess we don't need much proof because both Osama bin Laden and Yassin have proudly claimed credit for the many, many murders that they've done. But I think a trial would be a good idea. I think it would be a better idea. Sometimes it's not easy, though. In fact, one of the criticisms of the Clinton administration on the 9/11 Commission was that Clinton wanted to do it in a legal manner. He wanted to be able to capture Osama bin Laden and put him on trial. And there's a question, and we can talk about it more tomorrow, but there's a question as to whether or not Clinton gave permission to just go out and kill him. Sometimes I think when you have someone like Yassin, who murdered 377 and wounded 2,000, or Osama bin Laden, who's killed 3,000, sometimes I think the death penalty, the automatic death penalty, is the only way. I wish that weren't the case. I like that Saddam Hussein was captured alive. I think his trial will prove very interesting. But, I am not a fan of the Bush administration. I do not believe the war in Iraq was a good war. At the same time, I do believe you've got to fight terrorism. And you have to do it in a way that respects civil liberties. But when you have someone who's actively said, I want to kill everyone. I mean, you have Yassin, who has said he wants to kill every Jew in Israel. He wants to get rid of everyone. He wants to destroy the Jewish state and is sending off children with bombs on them. I don't know what you do about that. Let's look at some of the things Yassin's done. Well, here we have this 16-year-old boy, all right? Here's what his brother said. This is the boy that was carrying the bomb. His brother said, he doesn't know anything. He has the intelligence of a 12-year-old. The teenager was Hussam Abdo, The family said he was gullible and easily manipulated. And, of course, he had this under his jersey. He had this this huge bomb. And when soldiers saw him with the bomb, by the way, they did not kill him. They did not kill him. They shut down the crossing and sent a robot to give him scissors to cut off the vest. The Associated Press reported the teenager cut off part of the vest, struggled with the rest. "I don't know how to get this off," he said in frustration before successfully removing it. What's interesting is that had Abdo's message succeeded, had his mission to kill the soldiers succeeded, he would not just have harmed the soldiers, he would have killed some 200 to 300 innocent Palestinians who were also there. And the Palestinians used children, the age 12, 13, 15, to do these attacks. And, you know, I don't understand how a family, I mean, I have to just think that these parents don't know these children are doing it. And I think that's true for some of them. But for other parents, we praise their children as martyrs. Why don't they just try peace? I don't understand. You know, another article I read in the Washington Post, a Palestinian this is Sunday, March 21st. It's a very small article on A25. A Palestinian militant group, they use the word militant, offered an unusual apology for mistakenly killing an Arab college student in a drive-by shooting in a Jewish neighborhood, calling his family to offer their condolences and declaring him a martyr. Yasser Arafat's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade said it carried out Friday's shooting in Jerusalem in which gunmen in a passing car shot the student twice in the head and once in the abdomen. The group apologized on Saturday after it was disclosed that the victim was George Khoury, 21, the son of a prominent Arab attorney. "Sorry, we meant to kill Jewish college students. We killed you, an Arab college student. We're so sorry. We're glad you're a martyr." And then people think that Israel should negotiate with Arafat? Arafat's sending these people out. I don't understand it. Maybe one of you can explain it to me. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. I want to hear from you. You can also send me an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name? Where are you from?
Justin.
Justin from?
From New York.
From New York. What do you think about all this?
Well, I actually kind of wanted to respond to something I had heard when I initially tuned into your program.
Yeah.
It's the first time I've ever heard it. Also,
okay.
I'm at work. So,
welcome to the program, by the way. Okay.
You asked why not try peace, why not try nonviolence like Gandhi did. And I think there's some very fundamental differences in that India and Gandhi had a much different economic impact on the British Empire. What Gandhi did were basically giant strikes, and they had an economic impact. The Palestinians don't have the ability to have an economic impact on Israel.
Actually, they have a pretty serious economic impact on Israel. It's been hurting Israel. The terrorism has been hurting Israel terribly. They've lost tourism. People can't go out in the streets to malls and restaurants and buses.
I agree, but what I'm saying is the Palestinians don't have the same kind of power over Israel. They don't have the same kind of bargaining chip. They don't really have anything that Israel wants other than land.
Do you think that Gandhi beat the British because of the economic impact or because he convinced the British people that his cause was just?
I think it was probably a little bit of both, but I think economics probably had a lot more to do with it. Also, there were also violent terrorist actions in India, to be sure. Gandhi obviously was one of the most visible activists, but there was also plenty of violence going on also, which also had something to do with why the British eventually left. Also, not to mention that the British were overextended. They were not just in India, as we know. They were everywhere else, and there were a lot of things, mostly economic factors, that figured into them having to eventually leave, and I don't think that I don't think there's a correlation between India under British rule and Palestine and Israel. I agree that I would personally prefer if they would give peace a chance. I mean,
Justin, doesn't it make sense to at least try it? I mean, just to try to accept, for example, I mean, you have to agree with me, Arafat made a mistake at Camp David, right?
Okay, hold on. But you've also stated quite clearly on your show that 99% of the Palestinians who go into Israel are just going there to work.
And I think that's right.
And 1% of them are ruining it for everybody.
I think that's right.
Which I agree with. I think probably the majority do want to try peace, but that the problem is that the 1% does ruin it for everybody.
Well, but how can they get?
I think conversely, let's say the Palestinians gave peace a chance, they gave it a try, like both you and I would like them to, and Israel was like, okay, well, you know, we'll give you a state, you know, look what happened to Yitzhak Rabin.
Well,
there are extremists on both sides who don't want peace. They simply
there are extremists on both sides. I think you're right. But I think the difference, the fundamental difference between Israel and the Palestinians is that because Israel is a democracy and because the Palestinians aren't, what that means is if Rabin is killed, as he was, and the Israelis can still have a leader, can still, if the Israeli people are convinced that the Palestinians really want to give peace a chance, it doesn't matter how many Israeli leaders that are killed by the Jewish extremists, they will still have a democratic leadership all the Palestinians have to do is convince the Israelis they want peace. And Israel's tried it. I mean, they elected Rabin. They elected Barak. They are more than willing to elect the Labor Party, which is the more liberal left party in Israel, when they feel there's a chance. To me, the reason why Israel chose Sharon is precisely because they said, well, if Arafat's not going to accept this tremendously great offer that Barak's giving him, then maybe they don't want peace. In the Palestinian case, where I think you're right, I think 1% are the terrorists, although I have to say a lot more than 1%, I'm afraid, support them.
Yeah, more than 1%,
I would say. Well, a lot of them support them. I mean, I only think 1% are strapping bombs on their bodies,
yeah.
But they do have, I hope it's not over 50%, but they have substantial support. It may well be over 50%. They have substantial democratic support. I think if they were a leader, instead of Arafat, I think, frankly, I hope Arafat, and I'm going to say this on air, it's risky, but I hope Arafat dies soon of natural causes.
Because that would probably be good for everybody.
And hopefully, provably from natural causes, because
he's obviously not offering much to anybody. I don't think he has any positive role in the
process. All he does is cause problems. There was, in fact, it's interesting, a few years back, there was the mayor of Bethlehem, a Christian Arab by the name of Elias Frege. And Mayor Frege stood up and said, you know, I think we really need to lay down arms and have a peaceful negotiation. And Arafat said, anyone who challenges my authority will get 3 bullets in the chest. At which point Elias, within an hour, said, you know, I don't know what I was saying. I clearly didn't mean it. I apologize. Chairman Arafat, you are my leader. If the Palestinians truly could elect a leadership that wanted peace, again, I think that would make all the difference in the world. When Abbas, you may remember, when Prime Minister Abbas, who I, by the way, do think wanted peace from the Palestinians, and he was kind of on the ascendancy. He was kind of in control. In fact, I do think Israel should have helped him more. But instead, Arafat made sure that he had no power. And once Abbas is gone, now I really see no hope.
Yeah, I would like to also say something. You're saying that, well, they tried, you know, Israel tried to try peace, and Sharon is a result of the Palestinians not wanting peace.
I think so.
On the other hand, it could just as easily be argued that the Intifada is a result of Sharon.
The Intifada began under Barak, just to be clear. It began when Barak was prime minister, and then Sharon was elected.
A dove.
I think he was a moderate.
All right, well, in that region.
Yeah?
In that region.
Well, but you know, he was willing to give 95% plus of the West Bank. We can argue whether it was 95 or 98%.
But what I'm saying is that it seems like every time one side wants to maybe, you know, try to offer some concessions and give peace a chance, extremists on the other side ruin that. And I think both sides are obviously to blame. I do think that Israel probably has more of a moral responsibility in that they hold most of the cards and they're obviously much more powerful. You know, kind of like in Spider-Man, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
I think that's the difference, and that's why you see that the Palestinians are going and just trying to bomb buses and kill everybody.
I don't justify that.
I know you don't. But Israel's doing targeted assassinations. They are trying to kill the murderers.
There's quite a bit of collateral damage.
Well, right. We went to Afghanistan to get
as many Palestinians.
You're right.
Granted, many of them were militants involved in fighting, but obviously the people paying most of the price on both sides are innocent civilians.
You're right about
that. I think that's the saddest part about it. There was one other thing that I think I wanted to touch upon, something just a minor point, but it kind of actually offended me, what you said.
Okay.
Only because I recently had somebody said something quite recently to me that was very similar to that. You were talking about how Palestinians and Israel are complaining that, you know, they're poor and this and that, they don't have these rights, but, you know, they're much better treated than they are anywhere else in the Arab world. But recently I had somebody trying to justify slavery to me, saying that slavery was the best thing that ever happened to African Americans because they have it so much better than, you know, if they were still in Africa. And I kind of don't know if that's really the right way to state that.
My point, yeah, look.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't think that's really a justification for saying, well,
it's not a justification. What I'm saying is that at least the Arabs that live in Israel and have full and equal rights and you know, serve in the parliament and the labor groups and so forth, it was interesting to me that the mayor of this Arab town, Umm al-Fahm, which is the largest entirely Arab town that's in Israel, it was striking to me that as much as he was not a fan of Sharon by any stretch or means, the one thing that most upset him was the idea that Sharon would give his Arab town to a new Arab-Palestinian state, because I think he realized that whatever his problems with Israel, that he'd be better off than in a Palestinian state. No, I do not mean to suggest in any way justify slavery or anything like that. I do think, though, that people have a basic misunderstanding of some things that are going on in Israel, and I don't know, you know, do most people know that Israeli Arabs, not Palestinians, but the Arabs living in Jerusalem, living in throughout Israel, can vote, have equal rights, serve in labor unions?
Yeah, but Palestinian neighborhoods in Israel receive less than a fifth of the budgeted municipal services that the
Jewish counterparts
receive.
That's wrong. And I agree with you that's wrong.
The Palestinians may have Israeli citizenship, but the government only guarantees equal rights for citizens and non-citizens with Jewish nationality. I mean, it's a state based on ethnic lines.
How can that
truly be a democracy?
They give equal citizenship to. I mean, Israel has Hebrew and Arabic as its both its languages. Both Hebrew and Arabic are used in government on the money. All Arab citizens. They're actually very active in the labor unions. There is an immigration law, that's true, that says that if you're Jewish, you can move to Israel and become a citizen. France tends to prefer French and Germans prefer Germans and so forth. That's true. It's also true, by the way, in Arab countries, Jews have virtually no rights in most of them. I don't think that's quite the same.
There's a lot we could get into. I don't have all the information in front of me about, for instance, granting even Israeli Arabs land rights to build a house or dig a well. They simply don't grant them. Israel refuses to recognize the existence of many Arab communities, especially a lot of the Bedouin ones, and because the government denies the legality of these villages, it doesn't issue water permits to build or repair homes, dig wells, doesn't provide electricity, water, health services. It's more like they're equal. And much like our, here, blacks were, technically equal, but they weren't.
Well, let me agree with you.
There's a very similar thing going on. On paper, they're equal. They can vote, but I think in reality, it's quite a different situation, and it's based along ethnic lines, obviously.
Let me agree with you, Justin. I agree with you that Israel should do more for its Israeli Arab citizens. I do think they do have, as you say, equal rights on paper. I think they're treated a little bit better than blacks were until the 1960s in this country, and that, blacks really couldn't vote and were lynched, and you don't see that kind of stuff going on. But I agree with you that Israel should treat its Arab citizens better. I also think America should treat blacks in the inner city ghettos better. And I'll be the first to agree with you on that. I don't think it justifies strapping bombs on children, but I definitely agree with you that's something Israel needs to do. I do. I think you're right. Hey, thanks so much for your call, Justin. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has really been an interesting topic. Like I said, it's nice to not only talk about what's going on in Congress. I do want to get to that, and I'm going to get to that in the second half hour. I do want to talk about some of the stuff that's going on in Congress. I want to talk about the attempt to deny overtime pay. I want to talk about under God in the Supreme Court, whether that should be part of the Pledge of Allegiance. I want to talk about Scalia's refusal to recuse himself, about Foster's claim that the Bush administration refused to tell Congress about the truth in Medicare. We do have a little bit more time left, though, to finish up this topic. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. If you think I'm dead wrong, call me up, challenge me. That's okay. That's what this is about. I want this to be your voice as well. And I appreciate all the great callers we've had and really a good discussion. As I said, radio lets you do things that television doesn't let you do. It lets you go into, talk about history, really get into details and facts and back and forth so that it's not just a two-minute soundbite on TV. We're going to be back, and we're going to finish up this discussion on Israel. If you still want to have your voice heard, you can. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. 877-577-2667. Or if you want to talk about what's going on in Congress these days, you want to talk about overtime pay, you want to talk about what's going on in the Supreme Court with Under God being part of the Pledge of Allegiance, you want to talk about Scalia's refusal to recuse himself, all these things we're going to talk about on the Inside Scoop in the next half hour if you'll call 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
Hi. Senator John F. Kerry's presidential campaign is getting an unexpected boost from an unlikely bunch, former Bush administration officials and congressional Republicans. Some congressional conservatives are accusing Bush of driving up deficits and misleading the country about the cost of the new Medicare law, top Kerry campaign messages. Kerry's campaign is circulating recent Republican remarks that Congress would not have passed the Bush Medicare law if members had been told of its projected cost. The Office of Management and Budget estimated the law would cost about $130 billion more than advertised, but those numbers were kept secret until well after the House passed the legislation by one vote. The flap over the Medicare numbers threatens to turn the law into a campaign liability for Bush. The former chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq warned on Monday that the United States is in grave danger of destroying its credibility at home and abroad if it does not own up to its mistakes in Iraq. The cost of our mistakes with regard to the explanation of why we went to war in Iraq are far greater than Iraq itself, David Kay said in a speech at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Comments by Kay came as the White House sought to fend off accusations from its former anti-terrorism czar, Richard Clark, who said George W. Bush ignored the al-Qaeda threat before the September 11, 2001 attacks and focused on Iraq rather than the Islamic militant group afterward. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and William Cohen, his predecessor under the Clinton administration, are among those scheduled to testify Tuesday before an independent commission investigating the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. The public hearing comes at a time when the Bush administration is under fire for its anti-terrorism efforts, blasted in a just-published book by a former aide who says the president ignored warning signs before September 11, 2001, and later wrongly focused on Iraq at the expense of more vigorously targeting al-Qaeda. The book Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror, by former anti-terrorism chief Richard Clark, has been denounced by the White House as a wildly inaccurate account of the administration's effort, but Clark has stood by his assertions, saying Bush botched the response to 911.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today won't be around for our children and grandchildren. The Earth's resources are limited. Voluntary family planning improves health while helping slow population growth, and that's good for our planet. Help build a healthy future for us all. Visit www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
A New Mexico fast food restaurant worker is accused of spitting into a police officer's hamburger. He was arrested and charged Saturday with assaulting a police officer and altering food, both misdemeanors. The officer noticed there was something wrong Saturday after he took two or three bites of his hamburger. After inspecting his food, the officer found someone had spit in his burger. The worker remained jailed Monday on a $2,000 bond. For a Minuteman News Service, this is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
This is Mark Levine. Welcome back to the Inside Soup. We've had the Inside Scoop, I should say, not the Inside Soup. We've had quite a discussion about Israel and the Palestinian problem, and I really appreciate my callers who seem to have a pretty good understanding of a lot of what's going on, even though we disagree with a lot of them. And again, I think that's the importance of having a radio where you can talk and disagree. You know, some of the right-wing radio hosts, Rush Limbaugh, I remember a few years ago, I actually tried to call on his show, tried to disagree with him. Couldn't get past the screener, because the screener found out that I knew what I was talking about, and I couldn't get on the show. One of the things that I like to try to do, and I think it's very important, is to hear all points of view on any issue, whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian issue, whether it's liberal-conservative issues. It's important to know your facts, and it's important to get your views across. And if you want to be heard, please call in. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. I got another caller on the air. Caller, what's your name, first name, and where are you from?
Well, it's Mike from Minnesota.
Hey, Mike, I remember you. You're a regular. I like that.
Okay, good. I'm glad you appreciate it. Great, Mark. I appreciate your work here, too.
Tell me, what do you think about all this? You agree with me? You think I'm dead wrong?
Well. You know, I tuned in a little bit late. But,
okay.
You know, I do have some strong feelings about this. But
okay.
My feelings are in general, and I have to kind of back away from the whole situation and try to take the big picture. And I really think that your last caller, Justin, I believe, really hit a lot of solid things. And one of the things is, objectively speaking, it seems to me that what happens over there seems to affect the whole world. And the world watches, and that's almost a testing ground of the whole political climate of the world. And I think Israel has an incredible responsibility in that situation to do the right thing. And they've been, like you said, you two said just recently, they've both been so close to having a situation, and then boom, it all goes right back up into flames.
I actually thought in 2000 that they were going to make it.
I did too. And I was really pulling, and you know, and the world was. But the truth of the whole thing is it's the David and Goliath story, to bring up a biblical thing. And your Palestinians are play the part of David in that situation. It's quite a role reversal. But, you know, like Justin said, Israel has the power.
Yeah, but see, they're using bombs, not slingshots.
I understand. But that vicious cycle of violence, number one, as liberals or whatever you want to call us, however we all are that are listening, we have to step back. And sometimes we catch ourselves saying, like, well, it's okay to do this and kill that and kill that. But you know what? I mean, is it really? I mean, what they're doing is just they have that feeling of we have to hit back any way we can. And because we're not the huge power here, we're going to do it the way we have to do it.
But see, what I don't understand is this. You know, I do think there's an incredible difference between this idea, by the way, that they're going to...
It doesn't matter. They're both vicious.
Well, no, but they're not. It's not the same thing. Hang on, Mike. I mean, you have long before the intifadas, I mean, Arafat made his mark killing children at the school at Ma'alot in northern Israel, where he took a bunch of children hostage and shot 23, 6, and 7-year-olds. I mean, that has always been their strategy. And I would say that for 30 years that strategy hasn't worked.
Anybody on that thing, and retaliation brings you right down into it again. And
Mike,
sending out a message, trying not to get everybody to strap the bombs on.
But Mike, wait a minute.
Let's all set back here.
Okay, let's go back. I mean, we can go back to the 70s when Arafat, like I said, was taking over schools and killing little children. If you don't fight back, does that lead to peace? I mean, you're saying they shouldn't retaliate?
Potentially. Well, I'm saying that you can't. I mean, Mark, you got to admit it. Isn't it a joke? I mean, your other callers have said it too. Sure, Israel's really great at it. They throw a missile here or there at somebody in a wheelchair. You can't see the stupidity of the whole situation.
Well, I see it's a bad symbol, but I also know that this guy in a wheelchair. By the way, Israel didn't put him in the wheelchair. Apparently, he had a gymnastics accident when he was in his 20s.
Amazing.
But this guy has proudly talked about the blood that he's helped spill.
You've got two dogmas that are going against each other, but they are. I think the point to remember here is that these are both the extreme sides of it. And
there are
a lot of people that want to make everything work out over there. And do you believe, I have to ask you, do you think that the Palestinians and Israel can coexist within the same land? That's the biggest question.
I think they can have two separate states separated by a wall. And if Arafat would,
that's the only way, a wall with a gun and that kind of a deal, huh?
Well, I think that if they had two separate states with a, I think they tried to coexist in a single state for a long time, and it didn't work. I think that if they had two states with a wall, the whole bit, and they each just left each, well, let me just finish. If they left each other alone for a bit, and each had their own state, and had their own economies, and just got out of each other's hair for a bit, much as, I mean, India and Pakistan have had constant wars, but they're not fighting every single day. All right. If they would just split up, I mean, like a bad divorce, you know, and live in separate places and go their own ways. And then maybe, and it may take 30, 40, 50 years, but maybe in 50 years, then they can, you know, Europe had to put up the boundaries before they could come together as the European Union again.
Well, that's true.
And I think it's just necessary. I think they've tried to coexist, and at this point, a wall, unfortunately, good fences make good neighbors. That's my view.
Yeah, well, in the same, when you say that, Mark, you're also admitting that they that those two races, or I'm sorry, whatever
peoples, let's say peoples,
people cannot coexist together.
You know,
you're admitting that.
You know, like I said, sometimes you got to get from point A to point B by going through point C. I think that maybe, hopefully, in a century they can coexist. For now, I just think separation is the best option. I want to hear what other people think too.
Sure.
The number is 877-57 Scoop. I'm not getting rid of you, Mike, though.
Oh.
I just want to give out the numbers. 877-57 Scoop. Hey, Mike, let me ask you this. When you say the whole world is watching the Middle East and Israel, I agree with you. I think that's the case. I want to ask you, why do you think that is? Why do you think that when Algeria massacres thousands and tens of thousands, as they're doing today, of their own people, It doesn't get any press, hardly any, in American newspapers. Europeans don't even know it's happening. And yet, when Israel kills a terrorist leader, suddenly it's a huge deal. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a good question. But you know, what is fed to us through the media is not what we sometimes select. And we're spoon-fed here. Wouldn't you agree with that? And I don't think, you know, I mean, if we had the apparatus and the media to see what's happening in Algeria and Albania and wherever else, we just don't see it, do we?
No, I think that's the difference.
Shown.
The difference is that Algeria will not allow CNN in, and Israel will allow CNN in. And because CNN can take pictures from Israel, and because they can't take pictures from Algeria, what's interesting is they don't report what happens in Algeria. They barely reported what happened in Rwanda when he had a massive genocide because it was hard to get pictures.
Or Sierra Leone.
Or exactly. Another example. Or Liberia, where they had the children army. Really disgusting.
Exactly.
Back
then I was wondering why we weren't marching into a couple of countries, to be honest with you.
I guess I would just ask people who are critical of Israel, and there are absolutely, definitely reasons to be critical of Israel. Justin from New York, in fact, I thought brought up the best ones. I think Israel, while giving equal rights to its Arab citizens, could give more economic benefits to them. I'll be the first to say I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I would ask those that be critical of Israel, put it in its place. I don't understand these huge marches where you see people attacking Israel, and they're not attacking Algeria or Sierra Leone or Liberia or really brutal countries.
Oh, well, because, Mark, we cannot put Israel in that same category.
Exactly.
For God's sake.
I know we can't, but why is it that you see these massive marches, and I live in Washington, I see them all the time on the mall, these massive pro-Palestinian marches for what is really a very complicated and horrible situation where, you know, frankly, and I don't think their tactics are the same. I mean, I don't think it's the same to strap on a bomb and kill children and then to kill the leaders of the terrorist groups. I don't think those are identical crimes. But for whatever it is, whatever you think Israel's done wrong, why is it that we're not seeing huge marches against these other, I mean, far worse crimes in the world?
I don't know. What I'm trying to say is I don't see it, to me, when you argue with a fool, you become a fool. So as far as I'm concerned, whoever started it or who's doing the more vicious side of it, it's those two countries that are involved in it. And that's what we're going to focus on. Israel's in the spotlight in America. That's all there is to it. And it's a major ally. And so we hear about it. And everything's spun to us to be pro. In general, I just feel that you have to kind of make up your own mind about this thing. And for many people, see the Palestinians as being oppressed.
See, in my view, if the Palestinians had half the I don't know what word to use, but maybe the political cleverness, let's say, of the Kurds in Iraq, who managed to get autonomy in their own state under Saddam Hussein, and who I support their right to an independent state, by the way. I support a Palestinian state. I also support the right to a Kurdish state. But you don't do it by going around massacring people. That's just not the way to get...
Well,
I'm surprised they get as much world support as they do, frankly, given that the Palestinian leadership, at least, has taught the whole world what terrorism is about. And I just wish they'd try another way.
It's in the spotlight, and that's why we see it. And you may sense more negativity towards Israel, but I mean, I think we all feel pro-Israel. We want
more in Europe than in America.
Pardon me?
There's more anti-Israel feeling in Europe than in America. You're right. In America,
even in America.
No, in America, you're right. I agree with you. In America, more people are pro-Israel. In Europe, more people are anti-Israel.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah. See, I'm afraid I can't. All I can say is the big picture, and the big picture is the cycle of violence has to stop.
I agree.
And that's a fundamental.
And how would you stop it?
Say it again?
How would you stop the cycle of violence? I mean, I don't know if there's an easy answer. I want to hear it.
It was already established. I mean, they had the plan all set up, like you said, 2000. Why all of a sudden it's got to go back to ground zero? Somebody push the damn thing through. Make it work. Give somebody some space.
Well, what do you do?
The fighting.
Well, what do you do in 2000 when Clinton works overtime, weeks and weeks and weeks, in Camp David, and I give Bill Clinton incredible credit for that, struggles to bring these people together, comes, gets, forces Barack, twists his arm, and gets, we can argue whether it's 95, 96, 97% of what the Palestinians want. And Arafat says, no, I can't do that. If I do that, people will kill me. What's the next step? What should the American president do other than what Bill Clinton did, which come out and say, you know what, Arafat's not serious about peace? I mean, what else can the world do?
Well, in that particular time, I'm afraid that was exactly all you could do. You know, every day is a different day, but Sharon is a tough cookie, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's very tough.
And right now, I feel that Israel is in more of a vendetta state than they are serious. You know, you go ahead. We're going to have some problems, but we'll be slapping you back real hard.
You know what? When Osama bin Laden killed 3,000 Americans on September 11th, I was livid. Right. I was very angry, and I'm no fan of this president, as we know.
No, we were all shocked.
But I was angry. I wanted to see them punished. I wanted to see Osama bin Laden dead. I'd still like to see him dead. I'm not ashamed to admit that. Maybe I should be ashamed for wanting someone dead. But I'd like to see Osama bin Laden dead. I'd like to see Al-Qaeda terrorists dead. And I'm a good liberal, right? But I gotta tell you, when I just think about what happened at the Twin Towers and the people calling their loved ones on the 92nd floor saying goodbye,
right.
You know, I just I look at what's going on in Israel, and I look at, you know, I mean, Hamas is going into discos and, you know, killing teenage girls. And it's like, you know, it's just, to me, it's very different, very, very different to go and kill a terrorist leader and to just kill everyday civilians. It's just not the same thing.
It's a much more civilized version of a horrible scene, which I am agreeing by saying that. But I have to say that, the senseless, I don't know, the violence has just got to stop.
How would you stop
it?
Seriously, I agree with, I mean, obviously, Mike, I think every decent thinking person in the world agrees the violence has to stop. What's your proposal?
Well,
give me an idea here, because I don't have one, other than a fence.
I'm saying that, I just cannot believe that adult people can't come to some kind of a conclusion without going in guns. I mean, it's,
I know you can't believe it, but look at the history of the world. I mean, you know, look at World War II, World War I, look at the Crusades, look at the Roman Empire. You know, I mean, I wish we lived in a world where people didn't react this way, but every century there's been war.
If you don't believe we can ever evolve out of it, then you can't help towards that.
And no, really, I think you can.
Just believe that there's a certain amount of decency in every one of us. Every child is born as an innocent, and
yep.
It's not that hard to come back to knowing what's really right and wrong. And I'm not spewing any specific religion or anything, and
yep.
I know I sound idealistic, but you have to keep these values to a certain extent. We all have to give in, and every now and then the gun gets shot, let's say. But as far as
hey, you know what, Mike, it's idealists who change the world. And so I respect your idealism and your hope for the future, and I think we can teach children not to hate. In fact, I think children are born not hating,
exactly,
and they're taught
hate.
That's
my point. Right, right. But I mean, it's an incredible area over there, and I mean, if step number one is just to quit retaliating.
And what do you think would happen if Israel quit retaliating?
Well, eventually, if they kept getting bombed and everything, ethically, Palestinians would be, in a way, their race would be disgraced. They would eventually stop their thing, and maybe somebody
you
would finally
so?
Get to some type of a conclusion.
Well, let me ask
why
you.
Can't we back it up immediately with that 2000 peace plan that we had?
Well, let me ask you this. If Israel were to stop retaliating, should they open their borders and allow Palestinians to come in to work, and also, which also allows terrorists to come in and kill them, or should
can
they close
I
their borders?
I can't go that far because I really don't know that much about that. I don't know. No, if terrorists are going to come in, if the violence will continue, then no. But, you know, you can't, and as I've tried to tell people about even when the I have a hard time even watching that Trade Center go down. I just can't even. I'm going to let about 5 or 10 years at least, or
yeah,
about
I know.
Five anyhow.
I know.
Before I can really feel the emotions, because
I agree with you.
You're watching 3,000 people die,
yeah.
And it's just almost insane. But
yeah.
My point is, you know, they you have to be empathetic, or what it is, you have to look into the eyes of the people who have done it. Do they? And understand what they must have been thinking. What, how badly do you hate us, and why? And if you're going to strap bombs on your children to the end of it, hey, look, you're never going to get rid of these guys then. You have to understand why they are feeling so abused. They feel like that 3,000, yeah, that was bad, but, you know, we've lost many, 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 or maybe generations, or whatever they are sore about. You have to understand what they're mad about. And now, I don't know how this relates to Israel, because...
Well, no, but I think I mean, I understand your point. I don't necessarily agree with you, but I love talking with you, Mike. I'm glad you're a regular caller. I do think we have to understand. I agree with you that we have to understand why people strap on bombs. We
Most
should understand
people do not
it.
Know why that... To this day, even the average Americans, we're political crazy people. That's why we're into this. But you know what I'm saying?
No, I agree with you that we need to understand. My view, frankly, is that, as I said, children are taught to hate. You've got Arab countries throughout the Arab world, Saudi Arabia, Syria, teaching, you know, in their sixth grade textbooks that Nazi propaganda, that Jews are out to control the world and to kill Arab children and this all this bit. And then they'll use pictures from Israel and Al Jazeera network to try to inflame. I mean, what we learned in the Holocaust is that, you know, decent, ordinary German children were taught in Hitler Youth to hate.
Oh,
racism.
Yeah,
people are taught racism. People are taught.
Okay, then are you saying that Palestinian people are that way as a race, then? They are.
No, I'm saying they're taught it. I am definitely not, I don't think any people as a race or ethnicity
right.
is naturally violent. I would not say that about anyone. No, I'm saying it's a culture.
It's like the Serbs and the Croats, right? They just cannot.
So I say Serbs and Croatia, build a wall, separate Serbia and Croatia, and maybe after 50 years they can come together. I think that sometimes we've tried everything else. I think we should try a fence. Hey, Mike, thanks
not
very
a bad
much.
Idea. Maybe it'll work.
Maybe so. Thanks very much for your call.
Thanks,
I got some other callers I want to get to. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine.
Yeah, hi. My name's Ron, and I'm in Indiana.
Okay, Ron, Indiana. What do you think about all this?
Well, first of all, when you started, you admitted to your bias for Israel, which is an honorable thing to do. We all start from our own biases.
True.
I did want to point out, though, you mentioned the strapping bombs onto people and blowing up things in Israel about 10 times, and not once, though, have you mentioned taking a platoon of tanks into a Palestinian neighborhood and driving over cars and trucks and sidewalks and blowing the heck out of houses, killing with the ostensible reason of killing some target, but usually killing a bunch of other people. The last time I checked, there have been about 6 or 7 times as many Palestinians killed in this ordeal as there have been Israelis. And I'm not saying who's right and who's wrong. In fact, I don't even know why we would care. I'm not pro-Israel or anti-Israel. I'm American. I mean, I wish them luck. I wish everybody luck over there.
Well,
but I think probably I have watched this thing. I'm old enough. I have watched. This thing has been on the front page of the newspaper in one way or another for my entire life.
Yep.
So it isn't going to... obviously someone wants it to continue. And who's at fault in terms of leadership? I think just like doing the tango, it does take two, and we have a confluence now of Arafat on one side, Sharon on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
The chances of that team coming up with anything peaceful when they've based their entire careers upon death and destruction, it just isn't going to happen.
Hey, Ron, what do you think about the idea of a fence? Just separate the two peoples and be done with
it. Well, I have no problem with that, but it's not our decision to make if they want it, and I don't think the Palestinians do. And I think
You think they do? I mean, why don't they want a state?
Well, the question is where the fence is going to be.
Why wouldn't they want...
If they put the fence up back at the original UN boundaries that were set up, you know, 50 years ago, I'm sure that would be fine. But
you have to pick which boundaries, because the boundaries have changed so many times, it's just hard to know which ones you're talking about.
The UN never did approve the Israeli occupation of the land, that, as you know. And as far as the Oslo Accords, apparently the people in power, nobody wanted that really to succeed, because, as you know, they continued... One of the reasons,
you know,
that fell apart was that the settlements continued to be built, and nobody did what they said they would do in those accords. So it was obviously, I think we as Americans have to take part of the blame. We've used Israel as our henchman in the Middle East for 50 years, and this has caused a lot of death and destruction on the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, and we've done it probably like so much of things now for the purpose of oil.
Hey, Ron, listen, I got to end my show very soon. I want to get to my inside scoop
on
Congress. But thank you very much for calling and expressing your point. I hope you listen tomorrow when we talk about the 9/11 Commission, a very, very different topic. Thanks so much, Ron.
You're welcome.
I do want to respond to Ron's points briefly. I mean, the reason why I guess I didn't mention tanks going into Gaza and all is because Israel left all the occupied territories they gave up in the Oslo Accord. There's always been a dispute over, you know, where the borders should be. But they left, let's say, most of the lands where Palestinians lived, places like Nablus and Bethlehem, and where more than 90% of the Palestinians lived. And they completely, you know, so they left these areas. And then when terrorism restarted in those areas, yeah, Israel came back in with tanks, because when they went in with soldiers in Jenin, in the refugee camp, they had strung tripwires in Jenin, and dozens of Israeli soldiers were killed. And in fact, at that time, I remember very clearly, the PLO claimed that Israel was massacring tens of thousands of Palestinians, and it was reported in the European press as if it were true. It was not true. So they went to tanks instead of the tripwires. It's a gruesome situation. And I would hope if I lived in the occupied territories and I were a Palestinian, I would hope I would avoid hanging out with the people strapping on bombs and wouldn't live close to them and, you know, around them. But it's hard. In a war zone, innocent people are killed. I can imagine all the innocent people that have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's why I just think separation, a fence, that's just the best way out. Hey, I haven't had much time to talk about what the Republicans are doing in Congress. I may end up talking mostly about that next week. I do want to mention some things now, and then I'll take one more call. We've had so many calls on this situation in Israel. I was just going to devote an hour to it, but it's really been a quite interesting discussion, and I'm glad we've taken it over more. Let's talk about some of the stuff going on in Congress, and if these things interest you, we can talk about it more tomorrow. Like I said, I very much want you to participate. One of the things that hasn't gotten a lot of press of what's going on in Congress is the overtime pay. The Republican Congress actually is not supporting the Bush administration on this one. The Bush administration wants to end overtime for a lot of workers that make more than $30,000 and less than $60,000. And I'm amazed that it's gotten so little attention. This is the kind of thing that you know, those of us that worked in Congress, we very much noticed. But it really has gotten very little attention in the mainstream press, and I want to talk about that more tomorrow. Why this hasn't gotten much attention? After all, you've got millions, tens of millions of American workers that rely on overtime. The whole premise of overtime, of course, is that, you know, you shouldn't have to work more than a 40-hour week. You should get time and a half if you do. And now the Bush administration is starting to end it, and there's been a lot of machinations in Congress. I'll explain more tomorrow. But I don't know who's going to win this battle right now. But I do think it's something we need to talk about. I also want to talk tomorrow, in addition to the 9/11 Commission, which will be mostly the focus tomorrow, about Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. What do you think? Do you think that it should be there? Do you think it shouldn't be there? I want to hear from you. I want to talk about Scalia's refusal to recuse himself from the Cheney Energy Commission and that whole duck hunt that they did. And I want to talk about the Medicare bill, the lies that the Bush administration told when you've got a bureaucrat who says it's going to cost more, tells Tom Scully at the Medicare chairman about this, and he says, if you tell that to Congress, you're going to get fired. I want to know why he's not fired. When did obstructing Congress become something that is not only approved of but loved of in the Bush administration? I thought obstructing Congress was illegal. Why isn't he in jail? I mean, how is it that, I mean, we have Oliver North convicted of lying to Congress, and this guy is trying to tell the truth. He's told, if he's told the truth, he's going to be fired. I hope they investigate. Other investigations going on. We're talking about Valerie Plame, the CIA agent that Bush officials disclosed to try to squelch the truth on Iraq weapons of mass destruction. I want to talk about the federal probe into the GOP staffers on the Senate Judiciary Committee that were looking into Democratic files. And I want to talk about the bribery allegations. Finally, the House Ethics Committee is coming out and talking about the proposed bribery to Representative Nick Smith of Michigan to agree with the Medicare bill. So we got to talk about all this tomorrow. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. Of course, the main focus is going to be on the 9/11 Commission and what Richard Clark has been saying. I got a few minutes left. I'm going to take just one more call. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. How are you?
Hi, Mark. My name is Rich. I'm from Chicago.
Hey, Rich from Chicago. What do you think about all this?
Well, you know, I don't have any fruitful comments, but I have questions, and you seem to be very knowledgeable about this, so if you wouldn't mind answering a couple.
Okay.
Israel to Palestinians, what's the population difference?
Israel today has about 5.5 million people, of which about 4.5 million are Jews and 1 million are Arabs. The Palestinians today have about 2.5 million in the West Bank and Gaza.
Oh, I didn't realize their population was so small. And then America
supports growing.
Israel. How much money does America?
America gives military aid. It gives, I think, it's $4 billion to Israel. It gives $2 billion to Egypt, and they are the largest recipients of direct aid. Now, if you compare it to, for example, how much we spend in Germany on NATO or Italy or in England, we spend tens of billions of dollars on defending Germany, Italy, and England. And, of course, we spent about $187 billion recently on Iraq. So that might give you an idea.
But the Palestinians, we don't give them.
Actually, we do. There's a provision in the Oslo Accords to allow Yasser Arafat's government to receive.
That's where I wanted to go. Because Arafat, I saw something on 60 Minutes where he has all this billions
of
dollars
in Swiss bank accounts.
What I don't understand is all these terrorists and these organizations, which really seem to be running organizations that rival a lot of large multinational corporations, why can't they ever use any of the infrastructure they have for good? You would think they would want to help the poor people. 2.5 million people with $1 billion. You'd think you could do some good to your people instead of strapping some bombs on it going to blow up some others.
I wish I had an answer to that, Rich. That's the great question.
All of them, Bin Laden, all of them, and their unbelievable ability to raise money, put together, yet they apply it for these most, you know.
You know, to me, it's the classic battle of. I mean, you look at the civil rights movement, the classic battle between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Hmm. The difference between taking a people that's been mistreated. And I'd be the first to say the Palestinians have been mistreated. I think they've been mistreated as much by the Arab countries as by Israel, but they've definitely been mistreated, and by their own leaders. And you take a people that's been mistreated, as African Americans were in this country, and you can either rise above it and preach nonviolence and show a democratic nation that your cause is just, as I think gay rights activists are doing now, as women did to get the right to vote, or you can just get angry and start fighting back with violence. And I don't think that ever solves it. And in fact, Malcolm X, before he died, started, I think, to realize that.
You're right. And somebody else earlier, either caller or yourself, made the point that it's a few people that are messing it up for the masses, you will. You know, there's very few people that are doing this. But, you know, some of it seems to me, it has a certain addictive quality to it, that it makes these people feel alive when they're bent on this destruction on others. And they don't know how to live outside of that type of of.
You know, I mean, I understand some of it. As I said, after September 11th, I'd be the first to say I wanted Osama bin Laden dead. You know, I completely understand that. But I people have to see a difference between fighting a terrorist leader, killing a terrorist leader. I mean, even if the Palestinians were to say, you know what, Sharon, because of Sabra and Shatila, he's an awful, horrible leader. We want to kill him. Even that, I think, would be far more justified than going into a disco and killing 21 Israeli schoolgirls.
And that's all fine, but I'd like to make one more comment, and then I'll hang up. And that is that once we started all this rhetoric of saying our president going, well, you know what, we should kill her, we need to kill this like Saddam or blah, 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 then the Israelis came up and said, well, you know what, we need to kill Arafat. Then the Chinese came up and said, you know what, we need to take Taiwan. And, you know, you just see all these people talking openly on the air, talking about how assassination is the right thing to go. And I'm wondering if at one point somebody doesn't stand up, you know, a new Russian leader and say, you know what, America is just too, we need to take out that their leader.
You know, I remember when Howard Dean was running for president and he said that what we got to do with Osama bin Laden is we got to try him, and I think he even said try him and execute him, and everyone had a field day, not just the Republicans but Democrats too. What, you don't think we should just go kill Osama bin Laden? You actually want to give him a trial? What, are you crazy? And
this
I
type of open speaking though, it scares me a little bit. You know, I mean, I don't know if we're not proliferating this type of thinking. You know,
well, it may be true.
Open on the airways.
Hey, Rich, I got to go. I hope you'll call back tomorrow.
Very lively debate.
I'm glad you enjoyed the show. I'm sorry to my other callers that are hanging on the line. We're not going to get a chance. I got to conclude at 5 o'clock. But it has been a very lively, very interesting debate. I hope you will call in. I certainly talk about other issues other than this one, though this one has definitely been one of the livelier ones. Hey, check out my website, RadioInsideScoop.com. I'm going to get that map. I'm going to get that map that was done in Camp David so that everyone can see it. And listen in tomorrow. I'm going to talk about the 9/11 Commission and all these other issues that I raised with what the Republicans are doing in Congress. We've got to give the inside scoop on Friday. But I do want to talk about the 9/11 Commission. I want to talk about Richard Clark, his explosive testimony, what it means, what Bush knew about terrorism, and what he didn't do about it. And, hey, if you want to support the Inside Scoop, if you want to advertise on the show, just send an email to advertise@radioinsidescoop.com. And while you're there, give a donation to radiopower.org, who's streaming me today. Hey, thanks very much for listening in. Tune in tomorrow for another edition of the Inside Scoop.